The following program, presented by the North Carolina Reading Service, is for an audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, a weekly journal, and it's read today by John Federson. This issue, weekly issue, is dated on April 14th of 2023, April 14th. As we often do for Indie Week, we go between the print edition, which was issued on Wednesday, and the online edition, which contains some articles which are more recently available. The first one from print edition, Durham, Tomasi McDonald, No Room at the Mall. Members of the Durham Planning Commission last month called a plan to redevelop the streets at South Point Mall transformational and massive. Then they voted overwhelmingly to oppose recommending the project to the City Council. At the heart of the Planning Commission's thumbs-down 10-3 vote was the complete absence of affordable housing in the redevelopment that will span more than almost 2 million square feet of land along Renaissance Parkway and Fayetteville Road. Low-income families and workers, such as those who staff the shops and restaurants, would, by default, not be welcome to live in the proposed development, which one commissioner likened to a new downtown district for southern Durham County. Despite the city's elected leaders' calls for equities and shared prosperity, the verdict is still out as to whether they will approve the rezoning of South Point for the mammoth mixed-use development. Council member Leonardo Williams told Indy this week that while the proposals have not yet come before the council, he and his fellow members, quote, are paying attention to ongoing developments with both Northgate and South Point locations. Williams said, look at what North Hills and Fenton in Cary did with, in addition to chain stores, adding boutiques and housing. South Point has to evolve, he added. The challenge is that it's really expensive. First of all, we have to decide what is affordable housing. What does that mean? Affordable housing for whom? We have to be very clear on what type of affordable housing we're talking about. Council member Jillian Johnson emphasized that the council cannot legally deny a rezoning due to a lack of affordable housing, adding that although the project has not yet come before the council, she is in a general sense supports turning parking lots into housing and retail space. Durham attorney Patrick Biker, representing South Point on behalf of the owner Brookfield Asset Management, said during a March 14 Planning Commission meeting that the development would take place on 7 parcels of land that are now parking lots. The plan calls for 300,000 square feet of office space, a 200-room hotel, and up to 1,382 apartment units. Planning Commissioner Nate Baker summed up the sentiments of the Commission's majority when he noted during the more than 1.5-hour hearing, quote, a lot of people are looking for places where they can live, where they can get to places and walk to places, and I think that's really important that we're creating a higher supply of those kinds of neighborhoods. Then Baker cut to the chase and asked Biker what percentage of the 1,300 units would be set aside for affordable housing. Biker added there would be no affordable units on the development site. And Biker added the developers would be looking at an affordable housing project that's in a qualified census tract that would give, quote, much greater bang for the buck in those housing venues. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, qualified census tracts are identified as communities with a large proportion of low-income residents. Okay, none, Baker asked. Absolutely none in the site? That's correct. So none, not in my backyard, reiterated Baker. And Baker explained affordable housing would not be financially feasible because the NC Housing Finance Agency requires 1.75 parking spaces per affordable unit in order to issue a tax credit. Biker said the financing gap per unit under current conditions with interest and building cost is around $65,000 a unit. In a qualified census tract, it's 45,000. So when you put those factors together, it's inefficient to try to build affordable housing that's not in a qualified census tract. Planning Commission Chair Austin Amendola asked Biker if the developer had made a proffer related to affordable housing at the redevelopment site. Biker answered, "We don't have a partner identified yet. We're waiting on the city and county to allocate ARPA, that's American Rescue Plan Act funds. That process is ongoing and should be done in the next several weeks. Once that plays itself out, we'll be able to identify where there's a shovel-ready partner where we can step in and provide financing." It's no secret that Durham has struggled in recent years to address a housing shortage that's felt most acutely by low-income families. The issue has been exacerbated by apartments that have become increasingly unaffordable and rapidly rising housing costs. This is particularly true in historically affordable neighborhoods near the city center, where gentrification is happening rapidly. The majority of the planning commissioners were not impressed with Biker's explanation that developers could not fork over an extra $20,000 to perhaps include 75, 50, or even one affordable housing unit in their plan to build more than 1,300. The commissioners were concerned that city and county employees, along with the mall's workforce, would not be able to afford to live at the proposed redevelopment site. Commissioner Stephen Valentine said, "I'm concerned about projects that come to us where the developer is not going to provide a good faith effort in an attempt to include affordable housing as a component of the project. I'm very concerned about that." Another commissioner, Gary Cutright, echoed the concern. "I don't want to beat a dead horse," he said, "but have you looked at providing units at just 80% to 100% of the average medium income, where we can get firefighters and teachers to be able to utilize all the amenities on the site?" And he added that he recognized the dollars and cents challenges posed by the inflated cost of parking spaces that accompany affordable housing, but he wondered if the developers could navigate through their own financial models that don't have the same constraint from financing via a qualified census tract. Biker said the developers did indeed evaluate building affordable units at the 80% average median income, and he said it was not financially feasible given the underwriting standards of our financing partner. It was not feasible given the parking requirements of the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency. It's simply not something our financial partner is able to approve. Another commissioner, Anthony Sees, said the issue of affordable housing had not been treated sufficiently by hanging it on the efficiency question or the census tract designation, adding, "Because, yes, we may have less efficient yield of the number of units of affordable housing, but the people who work at all the stores get here by bus today, a lot of them. And the ethos you'll hear expressed over and over in this community is that people should have equity and more access. And I think that includes equity and access and seeking ways to include some affordable housing." He also pointed to very, very small projects south of the redevelopment location that have come before the Planning Commission that included an offer of affordable housing on site. And he said, "Given the scale of this project, I would encourage the applicant to consider ways around these issues." The mall, unlike a number of indoor malls across the country, remains vibrant. South Point's 140 retail shops account for a 97% occupancy rate. And with 13 million visitors each year, it's Durham County's largest generator of property and sales taxes. While noting that the mall is facing increasing competitive pressure from mixed-use districts in other nearby cities, Biker cautioned, "The worst thing you can do is rest on your laurels. This is about South Point's future and creating success for another 20 years. Meanwhile, Baker pointed to Durham's 4-year comprehensive plan and listed points in the plan that appear to be diametrically opposed to a redevelopment plan at the mall, which opened its doors in 2002 and spurred unprecedented growth and development in southern Durham County. The plan, Baker said, calls for developers to collaborate with residents in proposed mixed-use communities and, quote, focused on those most in need of affordable housing and transportation. And he also noted while the plan encourages the retrofitting of aging and vacant shopping centers for development, it also encourages pedestrian-oriented places that include affordable housing that provides reasonable access to necessary goods and services. The goal, said Baker, is to equitably distribute affordable housing throughout the county. Quote, I'm simply not willing to abandon all the work we've done putting together this comprehensive plan. The big question here is this going to be a giant exclusionary private development, or will this weave into the fabric of the city? Amandolia, the Planning Commission chair, was even more succinct. Quote, I'm hearing about market rate housing here and affordable housing there. It sounds a lot like segregation, he said, and emphasized that people who do service at the mall can't live there. It's wrong. And as a related article, very closely related, Lena Geller offers a second article about the Habitat of Humanity for Durham. Last week, confusion erupted in response to Indy's publication of an April 3rd letter sent from Habitat for Humanity of Durham to members of Durham City Council and Board of County Commissioners, in which a spokesperson for Durham Habitat stated the organization did not authorize its co-sponsorship of the proposed SCAD, SCAD text amendment, to Durham's zoning ordinance. The letter, which also stated that Durham Habitat's involvement proposal, quote, was enacted through an unauthorized third party, and noted, quote, the same third party has been speaking and negotiating on behalf of Habitat for Humanity of Durham with members of City Council and others, seemed, to many observers, inaccurate and easily refutable. While Durham Habitat had requested 3 weeks prior that its name, quote, be removed from all documents regarding SCAD process and application in a memo, readers were quick to point out that representatives of the organization had publicly expressed support for SCAD on numerous occasions in the year since the text amendment was submitted for approval. SCAD stands for Simplifying Codes of Affordable Development, and it was submitted in May of 2022, and until recently named Raleigh developer Jim Anthony and Durham Habitat as co-applicants. And there's an initial cover story available from Indie Week. But documents and emails from both Habitat and SCAD-involved parties obtained by Indie show that Habitat did not authorize its co-sponsorship. They also reveal the identity of the alleged third party, a Durham builder and sometimes Habitat volunteer, who is associated with local companies that own a significant number of properties in the city's urban core, led the fundraising effort around writing and filing the proposed text changes, and drafted a large portion of the changes himself. Finally, the records indicate the city made a significant misstep in its review of the SCAD application, according to guidelines set out in the Unified Development Ordinance. At nonprofit organizations, all key decisions must be made by the board of directors. According to the minutes from Durham Habitat's April 7th, 2022 board meeting, the board did vote on a motion related to SCAD. The minutes read, Board Member Leon Meyer's motion that Habitat support changes to setback, flag lots, parking lots, and residential development in commercial zones, say the minutes. Another board member seconded and the motion carried. Indeed, on the second page of the original SCAD application, Durham Habitat is identified as supporting four specific elements of the proposal: setback modifications, flag lot, parking requirement, and the allowance of residential construction in non-residential district. But supporting four provisions is different from co-sponsoring the entire text amendment. To authorize Durham Habitat's role as a co-applicant of SCAD as stated on the first page of the original application, the board would have had to put it to a vote. That vote never happened, according to the board minutes and Habitat officials. Durham developer Bob Chapman, who has assisted in funding and crafting the SCAD proposal, recently provided three emails to Indy that he says prove Durham Habitat signed off on its co-sponsorship. The emails involve exchanges between Leon Myers, who then served as a general board member of Durham Habitat, Vicky Garcia, who then served as chair of Durham Habitat's board of directors, and Aaron Lubeck, a Durham builder, designer, and the registered agent of at least two companies that own more than two dozen properties in Durham. Seconds after this story went to print, and after our requested deadline, Lubeck responded to the Indy's request for a comment. But Chapman says Lubeck helped initiate the creation of SCAD, and alongside Durham real estate development consultant Dave Olverson, penned the bulk of its text. Chapman told Indy that SCAD, quote, grew out of work that Lubeck was doing for Habitat for Humanity a number of years ago. At the time, Lubeck had jotted down regulatory issues that thwarted the organization from building housing, Chapman says, and many of those issues are what SCAD seeks to resolve. Chapman also credits Lubeck with securing the money to fund SCAD in order to pay the city's filing fee and pay Olverson for his work. Lubeck raised $30,000 in donation, says Chapman. Most contributors donated between $1,000 and $1,500. At some point during the fundraising campaign, Chapman says Lubeck reached out to Myers, quote, his friend on the Durham Habitat Board, to seek the organization's support on SCAD. That request ultimately led to the email exchange that Chapman says conveyed an authorization of co-sponsorship. Neither Myers or Garcia responded to Indy's request for comment. The first email, dated April 25th, was sent from Lubeck to Myers. He wrote, the application copy for the text amendment is attached. It calls out Habitat's support specifically, as you suggested. Please let me know if there are any problems with this. The next email shows Myers passing the message along to Garcia, the board chair. Quote, Aaron Lubeck sent this draft application for Durham UDO changes to confirm that its statement regarding Habitat support for the change is consistent with the board's actions on this matter. It looks fine to me, he wrote on April 27th. Could you please confirm? A few hours later, Garcia replied, looks good to me. Thanks so much for your work on this. But the attachment referenced by Lubeck and Myers was not included in Chapman's printed out copies of the emails, which were neatly formatted on white paper with key lines highlighted in yellow. When the Indy requested to see the emails in their original form, with the attachment included, Chapman reached out to Lubeck, who reported to Chapman that he could not produce them, Chapman told the Indy. It is not clear then whether the attachment in question was just the second page of the application with Habitat's agreed upon support of those four provisions. Until March 1st, when Indy published an article naming Durham Habitat as a co-applicant of SCAD, the board was unaware of Durham Habitat's alleged official co-sponsorship role in the proposal, according to Carlina Dionanen, a longtime member and current chair of the organization's board of directors, a role in which she served since November. One day after this revelation, the board voted to withdraw its name from SCAD. Then it launched an investigation. In interviews covered by the board, Garcia, Myers, and Jim Bellinger, who took over as interim CEO of Durham Habitat in March of 22, all said they had not at any point communicated an authorization of co-sponsorship to Lubeck, Anthony, or city staff. On March 14, Bellinger signed an affidavit stating that in his role as interim CEO, he did not authorize the filing of the application with Habitat's name included. But as people pointed out at the Planning Commission's December 13th meeting, Bellinger stated, Habitat for Humanity of Durham is supportive of this proposal. He said that during a public comment period on SCAD, adding, we're facing headwinds, gentrification, inflation, rising costs of land, the number of people moving in. They're all big issues that Durham Habitat can't really address. but these proposed amendments help. These are things that will help us build homes and solve problems. At a joint city-county planning commission on August 3rd, too, Nicole Tyra, Durham Habitat's then new director of construction and planning, said her organization, quote, had been involved in the text amendments. Most of these changes allow us to make very thoughtful and best use of the lots we do have in our land banks so we can continue to provide more and affordable housing in the Durham area, Tyra told the joint meeting. But at no point in either meeting did anyone, Bellinger, Tyra, Overson, public commenters, commissioners, nor planning staff, explicitly state that Durham Habitat was a co-sponsor. At both meetings, the format is the same. Overson gives a brief interview of the proposal before leaving the stand to allow others, whom he describes as people we've been working with on creating this, or a couple of other folks, to speak. A Durham Habitat representative expresses support, as do Steve Toller and Tiffany Elder. Toller says he's led the community engagement process around SCAD. Elder identifies herself as the co-chair of The Collective, a consortium of black real estate professionals in Durham, she says, has been active in helping to shape SCAD. Bellinger, Tyra, Toller, and Elder all appear to be speaking in the same capacity, but only Durham Habitat's name is listed as a co-sponsor alongside Jim Anthony's on the application. In March, as Durham Habitat's board was investigating how exactly the organization became listed as co-sponsor, Lubeck's name came up again and again. In emails between Lubeck, Myers, Tyra, and former CEO Alexi Vaughn, dated February 22, Lubeck stressed the importance of the organization's co-sponsorship. Vaughn stepped down from her role as CEO in March of 22. Lubeck wrote in a February 20th email, having Habitat as the applicant would expedite the process and help as we get into the dog days of process this summer. I know the votes are on council. It's just a matter of us getting it there. It's a much steeper hill to climb without Habitat on board, he wrote in another email. On January 4th of this year, Lubeck and Overson gave a presentation on SCAD during a Durham Environmental Affairs Board meeting. The minutes from the meeting, which a number of city officials, including City Council member Deidreana Freeman, attended, and show that Lubeck repeatedly invoking Durham Habitat. At one point, a panelist asked Lubeck whether SCAD's proposed progressing toward affordably toward housing program would require for sale homes to remain affordable beyond their initial sale. Lubeck replied, it was very clear for the applicant, which is Habitat for Humanity, that homes will not have restrictions on affordability upon resale. The PATH program is not one of those four SCAD elements that Habitat expressed support for. And Dionanan told Indy, the affordability aspects of SCAD do not comport with Habitat's affordable housing model. Lubeck, as the alleged third party, has helped shed some light on an unsolicited email the Indy received from Durham Habitat on February 9th while reporting its original story on SCAD. In this email, Tyra and Tiana Joyner, who took over as Durham Habitat CEO in January, stated, we work for one of the applicants, Habitat for Humanity of Durham. They continued, Durham Habitat is an applicant on SCAD because we're on the front lines of affordable housing, and as Durham has boomed, our work has become increasingly difficult. But a January 23rd email from Lubeck to Tyra, forwarded to Indy by Dionanan, reveals that the statement was not written by Durham Habitat, it was written by Lubeck. Lubeck wrote in the email, hoping to have you send quote to L. Geller at IndyWeek.com, something of this sort. She'll likely seek it to interview, so I have created a small barrier to that, should you want to use it. And let's see. Hey, Lena, it's my understanding that you are doing a piece on SCAD provisions, which I have heard is possibly going to be negative coverage of the applicants. I work for one of those, Durham Habitat. I have reservations about being interviewed, but you can quote me here. Nicole Tyra here from Habitat. I'm Director of Construction. We're applicant on SCAD because we're on the front lines of affordable housing, and as Durham has boomed, our work has become harder and harder. End quote. The rest of Lubick's message parallels the statement Indy Week received from Tyra and Joyner on February 9th, almost word for word. While the two staffers didn't copy and paste the statement, they edited it to be more concise and signed it with their own names. There's a reason why the word applicant didn't set off any alarm bells. Joyner says during her first week on the job as CEO in early January, Lubick requested to meet with her. At that meeting, Lubick told her Durham Habitat was one of 30 applicants of SCAD, she says. On March 8th, one day after Durham Habitat requested in a letter to City Council and County Commissioners that its name be removed from all documents, Lubick emailed a Joyner with a message that Dionanen says all but solidified his role as the unauthorized third party. He wrote, I'm obligated to discuss the withdrawal with the City Council members who have stuck their neck out on behalf of Habitat. I don't understand why you would be obligated to speak on behalf of Habitat to City Council. Have you been speaking on behalf of Habitat? Politicians who stood up for Habitat are now exposed by the Habitat board move, and I need to tell them something. The next day, Joyner sent Lubick a cease and desist letter. Quote, during the course of our correspondence, we've become aware that you have been speaking on our behalf and garnering support from local politicians using Habitat for Humanity of Durham as it relates to this text amendment. Although we appreciate all your work as a volunteer, in an effort to maintain clear boundaries, we must inform you, you are not authorized to speak or represent the interests of Habitat for Humanity of Durham. While SCAD proponents have argued in recent weeks that Durham Habitat request to withdraw its name was sparked by the Indies March article or by so-called NIMBYs, NIMBYs, coercing Habitat board members, Dionanen says all external pressure related to the organization's stance has, in fact, come from the proponents. Trinity Design Build President Alan Sproit, for example, sent Durham Habitat a letter that condemned the organization's 11th-hour withdrawal of support. He wrote, I wonder why, after providing several years of free site planning and related consulting, Habitat decided to thank Aaron Lubeck for his pro bono contributions with a cease and desist letter. SCAD proponents have also threatened and harassed Dionanen and Joyner over the phone. These calls have been particularly unsettling, says Dionanen, because she and Joyner are women of color and the harassers are all white men. We didn't get spooked, Dionanen says. We got smart. Of all the evidence suggested that Durham Habitat never authorized its role on the SCAD proposal, one piece has been hidden in plain sight since last May. The organization never signed its name on the application. Both Anthony and Durham Habitat are listed as applicants, but only Anthony signed his name. It's particularly bewildering, then, that Durham Planning Director Sarah Young, nor anyone else in the City County Planning Department, ever verified the organization's co-sponsorship. That's a basic step that the city's development ordinance mandates for all applications for development approval, including text amendments, that are not initiated by the city or county. Young did not respond to Indy's request for comment. Section 3.2.4 of the UDO states, upon receiving an application, quote, the director of the appropriate department or designee shall review the application and confer with the applicant to ensure an understanding of the applicable requirements of this ordinance, that the applicant has submitted all the information they intend to submit, and that the application represents precisely and completely what the applicant proposes to do. This never happened, Dionanen says, nor did the pre-application conference mandated by the same section of the UDO, at least not when anyone from Durham Habitat was around. On March 7th, shortly after Durham Habitat requested the city remove its name from all documents, Young emailed a Joyner to ask whether, quote, the other applicants, quote, had been notified of your withdrawal. Before Joyner responded, Young sent another email stating, quote, we cannot remove Habitat from the application itself as we do not have authority to modify someone's application. Joyner, unsure of how she was supposed to contact the other applicants on a proposal with which Durham Habitat was minimally involved, replied, I reviewed the application and I see James Anthony as a signer. Can you please share with me any additional information that provide Habitat support and authority to be included? Young wrote in a reply, the only document we have with Habitat listed is the application. While Jim signed it, he listed Habitat as one of the firms, though Habitat did not sign. That's the only place Habitat appears that I'm aware of. Notably absent, while all this unfolded, is the only ostensibly authorized applicant, Jim Anthony. Anthony has repeatedly not responded to IndyWeek's request for interviews. Given recent revelations, it's unclear what exactly his role in the proposal is. Chapman, while showing Indy emails between Lubeck and former board members of Habitat, may have dropped a hint. He mentioned that Anthony in the past helped one of Chapman's builders get approved for a bond on a previous project he did for Duke University. Chapman said, I approached Duke officials and I said, if Jim Anthony signs a guarantee, would that work? And they said, his signature is as good as gold. Upon closer inspection, it looks more like pyrite. Theonanen asks, why do they need our support so badly? Why did they need to commandeer Habitat? Why did they make us the Trojan horse? Well, and this is portion of this show is apparently housing oriented, because here's news from the town of Cary, which hopes to be the latest beneficiary of Wake County's assistance program created to boost affordable housing development in an area starved for it. When Lorena McDowell arrived in Wake County 4 years ago, the number of naturally occurring affordable housing units had been dwindling, and developers had little incentive to replenish the supply in one of the country's fastest-growing counties. The lack of affordable housing would soon turn into a crisis. McDowell, who leads Wake County's Department of Housing Affordability and Community Revitalization, says, it's only worsening. We have left things to the open market for far too long, assuming that it would just correct itself, and that never happened. Finding ways to boost affordable housing production sparked the county to create McDowell's department, which she joined in 2018 as its first director. Her work as Atlanta's deputy director under Mayor Kasim Reed helped reduce homelessness in the metropolitan area by half. She says, I'm glad Wake had the foresight to start this work years ago. It's what brought me here. I was excited to hear about a county that was willing to create a whole department to combat this issue. That was rare at the time, and now there are counties from around the nation that call us and ask how we did it. Administering $90 million in federal eviction relief during the COVID pandemic and overseeing a landlord engagement unit to help landlords understand the importance of working with the department are among the ways McDowell's department has tried to combat Wake's housing insecurity. The department is also responsible for a program that incentivizes developers to focus more on affordability in their housing projects. According to McDowell, this program is key in Wake because North Carolina does not have inclusionary zoning, meaning the department can't legally require developments to include units of affordable housing. Instead, McDowell's department allows developers to apply for county funds in exchange for providing affordable options. She says, if developers want our support financially, we're happy to do that. But for our dollars, they're then contractually obligated to hold a certain number of units affordable for a period of time. Our goal is 30 years. When that department was created, the department set a goal to create 2,500 legally binding affordable units through this support program within the first 5 years. That goal was met by year three. All told, it has administered funding in almost 3,000 units. They're in development across Wake County, with Wake-funded affordable and mixed projects in Raleigh, Apex, Zebulon, Garner, and more. The first wave of these nearly 3,000 projects is about to hit completion as more and more developers apply to work with Wake. One proposed development that hopes to find funding from the Department of Affordable Housing and Community Revitalization was approved in the town of Cary in November of last year, writes Nate Hopkins. The proposed development, set to be constructed at 921 Southeast Maynard Road, will be the first mixed-income housing development on Cary-owned soil. Assistant Town Manager Dana Widmar says the project, in partnership with developer Laurel Street, will, quote, introduce a first in affordable housing that will serve as an inspiration for future residential projects. The project hopes to secure almost $1.7 million in Wake County funds. The town of Cary had originally planned to use the land for a new water tower, but residents were unwilling to let go of the old tower, which Cary High Senior Class paints each year. Instead, the site, along with two additional acres purchased from Wake County Public Schools, was identified as a prime location for affordable housing, due to its close proximity to downtown Cary and the workplaces of many employed in the area. The development will also sit alongside a planned 2028 bus route between Cary and Raleigh. This development will consist of 126 three- and four-story housing units, over half of which will be set aside for affordable housing. 25 of those units will be made available to families earning 80% or less of the area median income, the AMI, for the Raleigh-Cary area, and 26 more will be made for those earning less than 50% of the AMI. 13 more will be set aside for those receiving federal housing subsidies. Morgan Mensa, Cary's Intergovernmental Affairs Liaison, says this development aims to connect all Cary residents and reduce the barriers for families to live in the neighborhoods they know and love. According to Mensa, the varied range of income levels that this development will cater to provides Cary with a range of unique opportunities that a strictly affordable development would not. She says, "We wanted to create a product that was mixed, where people from all different backgrounds and income levels can live together. That's what Cary looks like." While some worry that fully affordable developments have the potential to concentrate poverty, making it difficult for the area and its residents to grow economically and hindering the development of social safety nets, mixed-income projects are seen as ways to encourage both economic growth and community bonds by uniting different income levels. The uniqueness of the project, however, doesn't just lie in its affordability. Cary is committed to making sure that the development also emphasizes sustainability. The site will feature a wet stormwater retention pond, along with other green stormwater and drainage solutions. Community common spaces, like hallways and parking lots, will be completely powered by solar panels, and residents will have access to electric vehicle charging stations, capable of charging up to 14 vehicles. 42% of the total site will also be reserved for natural spaces, and a greenway connection will be constructed through the development. Now, construction of this development is slated for completion in 2024. Well, we'll shift gears now and go back to IndyWeek.com for a story originally published at NC Newsline. North Carolina's Compassionate Care Act, a bill that would legalize medical marijuana for certain patients, faces an uncertain future in the State House this session. But State Representative John Autry has turned his attention to another set of drugs. The Mecklenburg County Democrat is working to advance research on psychedelics. hallucinogens like magic mushrooms conjure up a certain image in some circles. Podocki says it's time to get past the stigma and look critically at the benefits of psilocybin, ketamine, and other such drugs when carefully administered. Dr. Raymond Turbin, executive director of the Pearl Psychedelic Institute in Waynesville, has been studying therapeutic use of psychedelics since the mid-1980s. He told reporters last week, "We have been conducting ketamine-assisted therapy for several years. We're currently participating in the FDA's expanded access program, treating people with treatment-resistant PTSD using MDMA-assisted therapy." He described one patient as a completely disabled veteran. Quote, "In his first MDMA-assisted session, he felt like it was 10 years of therapy in 6 hours. And we're seeing some incredible changes just within the last few weeks. These compounds have been around a long time." Turpin and other members of the recently formed NC Psychedelic Policy Coalition stress they're not talking about recreational drug use at home. Patients receive a medical screening and the supervision and support of a trained therapist and medical practitioner. Representative Autry's proposal would allocate $4.5 million to support two psychedelic medical studies conducted by North Carolina's Research University. A proposed psilocybin study would focus on reducing anxiety and fear in people with cancer and other life-threatening illnesses. A separate study would focus on reducing post-traumatic stress disorder experienced by veterans, first responders, and sexual assault survivors. The legislation would also create an advisory board of experts to make recommendations about how these medicines can responsibly be made more available in North Carolina. This bill would not make psychedelics available for retail purchase. The Pearl Psychedelic Institute is currently just one of a handful of clinics in the country with the FDA's permission to perform psychedelic-assisted therapy. Jonathan Lubecki, a retired Army sergeant, believes psychedelic medicine and research could help countless veterans. 2 months after returning from deployment to Iraq in 2006, he contemplated ending his life. At Womack Army Medical Center, he said he was given 6 Xanax, told to go home, give his guns to his neighbors, and come back after the holidays. "Instead, I drank a bottle of vodka," he told reporters. "I put a loaded 9mm to my temple and I pulled the trigger. A manufacturing defect in the ammunition is the reason I'm alive today." In battling PTSD and his traumatic brain injury, he attempted to take his life on 5 occasions before he discovered MDMA-assisted therapy. He took his first dose in November of 2014. Quote, "I've been PTSD-free ever since. I took it 3 times 8 years ago. I have not taken MDMA since." He said while he still goes to traditional therapy when he feels triggered, MDMA has been a life changer. Representative Alan Chesser, Republican of Nash, served with Lubecki in Iraq and has joined Autry as primary sponsor of the pending legislation. He carries with him the obituary of another service member who did not get help. Chesser said, "This isn't something you have to do every day for the rest of your life to maintain some semblance of normalcy. This is something that can give you a normal life back." A peer-reviewed study published in the New England Journal of Medicine last November found a 25-milligram one-time dose of psilocybin reduced depression significantly in patients who previously had treatment-resistant cases. Like Lubecki, Ken Maxwell wants to see the use of psychedelics expanded. The Asheville resident says psilocybin has helped him manage a rare type of cluster headaches he developed after a brain injury in 2012. Describing his condition, "It feels like a hot poker or a hot knife stabbing at the back of my eye." His debilitating headaches were helped with microdoses of psilocybin. Quote, "I've never once asked God why I got this disease, but I have asked God what I'm supposed to do. He said, I want something good to come out of it, and if I can help advocate and promote using these compounds in a responsible manner for their conditions, then that's what I'm calling it right now. The lone pharmacist in North Carolina's General Assembly also believes in the potential of this research. Wayne Sasser, Republican of Montgomery. I'm in the treatment business. I give you pills you take for the rest of your life. This is a cure. We need to follow up with this bill. He said, while the therapy is FDA approved, more research is needed to make sure any treatment is administered correctly. This bill will allow that to happen, he said. The Breakthrough Therapies Research and Advisory Act is still in draft form, but could be introduced when legislators return from spring break. If North Carolina takes that step, there will be others to learn from. In January, Oregon became the first state to legalize adult use of psilocybin. According to Stateline, Texas, Utah, and Washington are also funding their own research into the medical benefits of psychedelics. And in February, Australia became the first country to approve psychedelics and MDMA as a medical option for people with treatment-resistant medical illnesses. Mental illnesses, excuse me. Another story originally from North Carolina Health News, reprinted in Indy. Rose Hoban wrote, at least 4,243 people in North Carolina died from overdoses in 2022. Mary O'Donnell knows the pain of having a loved one die in such a situation. She's been fighting for years to get overdose numbers down. In 2017, her 17-year-old son, Sean, had been drinking with some friends at a quarry near his Chatham County home. His friends, afraid of being caught for underage drinking, left him behind when he passed out near the quarry's edge. At some point, Sean, alone and impaired, fell into the quarry and drowned. Mary O'Donnell thinks that a way to bring down the number of deaths related to alcohol or substance use is to make it easier to call for help. That's what she's been advocating for since Sean died. She said, young people do not want to risk getting arrested. That gets put on the record and impacts their ability to get into college, get jobs, etc. She's been walking the halls of the legislative building, talking to lawmakers about Senate Bill 458, which would strengthen the state's Good Samaritan law. The bill would increase legal protections for people who have overdosed, along with protecting the people who are around them. She said, if you're at a scene and somebody makes the call, then we've got to provide them protection. Currently, only the person who is overdosed and the person who calls for help are shielded from most prosecutions for substance possession. Sometimes even those people find themselves in legal jeopardy. The new bill would provide protection for everyone at a scene from arrest and from prosecution for nonviolent offenses. O'Donnell told reporters at a news conference, the North Carolina law is one of the most limited and complex in our country. Senator Bobby Hunnig, Republican of Powell's Point, a main sponsor of this bill. Too many people are dying needless overdose deaths. North Carolina's Good Samaritan law was passed in 2013, was done with good intention, but we've learned since there's some limits or limiting effects to it. For one thing, Hunnig said, the drug supply has changed. Fentanyl and other potent opioids and tranquilizers are being added more frequently to street drugs. At least 3,000 of last year's fatal overdose victims, more than two-thirds of all the overdose deaths, have fentanyl in their bodies, according to data from the State Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. Once fentanyl is in the mix, it's much easier to overdose. Help needs to come fast. That might be a first responder carrying naloxone, a quick-acting drug that blocks opioid receptors. While the current Good Samaritan law provides some protection for that person overdosing and the person who makes the call, others, the scene, could still be liable for prosecution, even if they're rendering aid. The prospect of getting in trouble, especially for people on the scene who might be impaired, can lead to inaction. Too often, no one calls. Hanick said, we need to be able to give a simple message, especially to our youth, that if an overdose death is happening, we should immediately call 911 without fear of prosecution. We need a simple Good Samaritan law with broad coverage. Senate Bill 458 would give everyone at the scene of an overdose protection from arrest and prosecution for nonviolent offenses, and give immunity for people who possess fentanyl without any carve-outs for certain substances and amounts, and make the protections apply for students calling security for an overdose on campus. Meanwhile, this year, the state Senate passed a bill that would toughen penalties for someone who provides the fentanyl that leads to an overdose. The so-called death by distribution bill would strengthen a current law to allow prosecutors to charge someone with second-degree murder if they sell drugs to someone who then dies of an overdose. That bill has not been voted on yet in the House of Representatives. Advocates say such bills dissuade people who use drugs together from calling when there's an overdose, because often they've sold drugs to one another, often to support their own habits. O'Donnell said they're really trying to get the big drug dealers with death by distribution. It's highly unlikely the big drug dealer is going to be at the scene of a party where people are sharing drugs. O'Donnell said supporters of death by distribution and supporters of Good Samaritan laws need to work together to find the middle ground. Lee Storrow, who works with Community Education Group, said, we wanted to introduce, and it was Senator Hanick's perspective as well, the strongest law that would send a clear message that we don't want anything to stop someone from calling 911. That includes exemption from death by distribution charges. Starrow, a North Carolinian, has been working to strengthen harm reduction practices throughout Appalachia for the past several years. Harm reduction is an approach to addressing substance use that aims to reduce the negative effects of drug and use abuse by providing sterile injection and drug use supplies, testing for hepatitis C and HIV, providing an opioid overdose reversal drug called naloxone, and other resources to people in active substance use. The idea is that someone might not be ready to stop using at a given moment, but they might be ready someday. Chandler Picot also spoke at the news conference. I mean, people need to be alive in order to get their recovery. Pico has first-hand experience with overdoses, including one where his mother called police when she found him unresponsive in his room. He experienced others that left him near death while he was still using. With the support of his sister, he's no longer using any substances and works as a peer support counselor who assists other substance users who are trying to get help. And he said, people need to be able to feel comfortable to call and share their experience and not feel like they're going to get in trouble for trying to save someone's life. Well, for the time remaining to me, I have about 4 minutes. The music columnist Spencer Griffith has written about a 1977 songbook called The Liberated Women's Songbook. For most of her adult life, Dawn Landes, L-A-N-D-E-S, Landes, had been moving her copy of the Liberated Women's Songbook from one coffee table to the next through a series of relocations, sitting down and thumbing through the photos and lyrics from time to time. After stumbling upon the book in a used bookstore over 15 years old ago, Landes mostly viewed the 1971 collection of 77 folk songs inspired by the women's lib movement and assembled into the anthology by Jerry Silverman as a curiosity from decades past. The aftermath of the 2016 election, though, led Landes to a concerted effort of digging deeper into the songs. She says, I've always been an advocate for women's rights and reproductive rights. I knew they'd be on Supreme Court docket, so when Roe fell, I knew it was coming. But part of me was just trying to resist in song, somehow by looking to the past for answers. Women have been oppressed for hundreds of years, so I wanted to learn what kind of music they were making then, because I wanted something to identify with. With reproductive rights, increasingly under attack in North Carolina and across the United States, Landis will present 18 selections from this songbook at Raleigh's Fletcher Opera Theater this Friday, and I guess that means Friday, April the 14th, 7 p.m. at the A.J. Fletcher Theater in Raleigh. That's downtown Raleigh. Let's see. As part of Pinecone's Down Home concert series, joined by a star-studded cast of mostly triangle-based musicians. Let's see. Landis moved to the outskirts of Chapel Hill in 2020, just prior to the pandemic. Despite the timing of the move, though, Landis, who was raised in Kentucky and Missouri, but also made homes in Nashville and New York, has been able to connect with a community of like-minded local singers through mutual friends. But it wasn't until last fall when Tift Merritt invited her to perform at Sing Out North Carolina, a Cat's Cradle benefit concert for reproductive justice, that Landis finally met many of her collaborators face-to-face. The event reaffirmed their shared spirit in fighting for women's rights. And she says, "It's kind of like we're suddenly back in 1971 all over again." That's 50 years, folks. "The grotesquerie of men passing anti-abortion laws that echoes today." Through Broadway connections, Landis reached out to Silverman's son, Antoine Silverman, an accomplished violinist, and was granted by the family to present the songbook project. Her next step was discovering more about the writers and backstories of each song. She credits a pair of triangle institutions. That's Duke's Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture and UNC's Southern Folklife Collection for assisting in her research for the event. Among the stories she plans to highlight are those of Ella Mae Wiggins, a union organizer murdered in Gastonia during the 1929 Loret Mill strike, and Florence Reese and Aunt Molly Jackson, who both wrote songs about the Harlan County War of the 1930s. Friday's performance will help tell the stories behind the songs through introductions, videos, and snippets of audio interviews. Well, I'm less than halfway through this article about Dawn Landis and friends at the Fletcher Opera Theater, the A.J. Fletcher Theater, downtown Raleigh. That's Friday, April the 14th at 7 p.m. with an admission price starting at $18. Singing Out. And that brings us to the close of Indie Week for the week of April the 13th. John Federson reminding you that you can visit IndieWeek.com for the entire issue, including articles I was not able to get to. And this broadcast will be shoehorned into our podcast folder section, which goes back generations of Indie Week, if you wish to hear any part of it again, including my name, which is John Federson. Oops, I've given it away. Well, we'll be back next week with another issue. Bye-bye.